Hello, dear listeners. Editing Leo here. Due to technical difficulties, or shall I say, catastrophes, our original seventh episode, An Interview with Kerry, was sadly lost. So what you're going to hear now is what we originally recorded as episode 8. We'll redo the interview with Kerry at some later point, but for now, I'll leave you with our interview with Lasse. I hope you'll enjoy it. I'm your host Leo, here with my co-host Livia today.
Hi.
And our guest Lasse.
Hello.
Would you like to introduce yourself, Lasse?
Yeah, my name is Lasse. I study English and I write sometimes.
That's good. That's kind of the prerequisite to be on the podcast. Just so you know, dear listeners, we are having a cozy tea time right now, so you might every now and then hear some of us sipping tea. I hope you can tolerate that. You can also get your own tea and you'll have a cozy afternoon with us. That would be really cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So, Lasse, let's start with your reading. Let's hear it. Would you like to tell us what it is and if it has a title?
I'm still thinking of the title. But it's a short story that I started writing. It's just the beginning of it.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, there was a smile. And I smiled back, two smiles. Then there was a hand running through my hair, warm and soft. Above the lips were two dark eyes shimmering in the light, and the air was full of sounds, one chasing the next. A second face appeared, a set of lighter eyes, rougher skin, another smile. In those days, the world was full of smiling people bowing their faces over me, peering at me. In those days, the world was there to play in and explore. But as soon as I got fed up with that, I returned home, where my mother was waiting, and I saw the dark eyes, the smile again. But there is never just a smile, never just love. When I play through my earliest memories, I see so much else. Her legs striding up to me, her narrowing eyes as she hunched over, and then her voice, which would drown everything else out, the birds, the wind. Her face was looming in front of me, everywhere, impossible to turn away from. Finally, she turned around and left, the earth trembling with every step she made. I lay back in the grass, convinced I would never see her again. As my heartbeat slowly returned to normal, I got up and walked through the empty streets and forest nearby, determined never to go back. Until I got hungry and cold, then I ran back into the house and into her arms, clutching her skin, digging my fingers deep into her back, not wanting to look at her face. After what felt like hours, my mother leant her face to my ear and whispered, "You're hurting me, my baby." She removed my hand, kissed me, and walked away. Maybe none of this happened, but it feels so real. It was a mystery to me how one person with the same body could be both as warm and as harsh as she was. Everyone else I knew was similar when I saw them, my father joking and playing with me. Andrew, a friend of mine with his puffed-out chest and loud voice, his older brother always greeting us with a sneery grin. With my mother, I would have to check her face, her body, every time I stepped in the room to see which one was there. There were other ones, too. For example, when she was in her study doing her writing, I would have to remain absolutely quiet there, and she would sit by the only window of the dark room, filled with shelves and shelves of books, motionless, staring outside with an intensity as if she were willing herself to fly out of the window into another world. In between, her fingers would brush quickly over the typewriter. At the end, she would yawn, shake herself, and walk over with a bright smile like we had spent the last hours laughing together. I quickly learned that those bright smiles were a good sign, so I would pass more and more time in her study, looking at the back of her face, waiting. Sometimes I would get pen and paper myself and stare into the distance like my mother, but all I could see were a lot of books and my eyes would slide along the book titles full of long, difficult words. Besides, where was the fun in sitting so still, I would think, kicking the air with my feet, and I would begin scribbling my paper full with little drawings. We lived at the time in a spacious house in a small town. The summers were full of sun and I busied myself kicking my ball around and exploring the neighborhood. Otherwise, I would hang around Andrew's place where we would sneak into his older brother's room, who I was quite afraid of, to steal some coins and then march out to the shop to buy sweets. The fear was followed by a wonderful feeling of excitement, so I extended the game to my own house and discovered, this time rummaging in my mother's purse, a banknote with a large 50 on it. I ran over to Andrews, my eyes shining with excitement, and presented to him the treasure I had found. We ran to the shop, stuck our fists full of sweets, triumphantly paid the old lady, who shook her head, muttering about children being spoiled by parents. We sauntered over to the nearby park and lay in the grass, dropping the pile of sweets between us. And when we started eating, we couldn't stop, daring each other to give up as the sweets turned sticky, the air felt ever more stiflingly hot, and my teeth hurt. We could barely walk upright on our way back, our stomachs hurt so badly, and Andrew vomited in the street. It didn't take my parents long to figure out what had happened. But where Andrew was given a long telling off, my mother started laughing and then felt I'd received punishment enough. At other times, I was in a little forest nearby, frequently by a pond I found, which only I seemed to know. Here I felt I could be everything. To daydream, I would sit under a large tree and listen to the trickle of water from the stream. When I was happy, I would lie in the sun listening to the buzzing flies and insects. When I was sad, I would stand over the water and stare into its depths, wondering what was hidden in its dark center. The pond would enter my dreams occasionally, in which a large woman would slowly emerge from the water. As she rose, the water's surface rose with her, unfurling itself around her body as if made of silk, until it rested on her shoulders in the form of a dark blue cloak, and she stood in a dry hole. She had long wild hair and a furious expression on her face. She let out a low, searching, bone-rattling howl, and I would wake up, heart beating, unable to get the sound out of my head.
Wow. That was, or that is, quite something.
Yeah, thank you for giving us that vivid picture of, or many vivid pictures of childhood memories, or what one thinks of childhood memories. It's really touching, and some of that seems quite familiar, I would say.
Yeah, all during that, when I first read it and now again, it really brings to mind, I don't know, yeah, what I remember childhood feeling like. I don't know if that's what it really felt like, but that's how it feels like in my memory. That's what it looks like in my memory. It's amazing that you can put that into words, I think. Because it's, for me, this feeling is really like visceral and kind of removed even from language.
Mm-hmm. So you mean it in a kind of emotional sense?
Yeah.
Probably not the same things happened to you.
Yeah, but similar emotions, I would say. Mm-hmm. I find the emotions familiar. Mm-hmm. And also, yeah, the kind of relevance of the forest for me. My parents' house is directly adjacent to a forest. And yeah, I used to spend a lot of time in the woods playing. Mm-hmm. But then also returning back home.
Yeah, I think that is a very universal thing, that children tend to want to move around and explore their surroundings and also experience personal adventures, or what they consider as adventures, but there's still always like this safe place, this haven to return to, where you know someone is waiting for you, whether happily or not so happily.
Yeah, I felt like that's a big part of it, the part of the feeling here of the protagonist, that there's a kind of ambivalence in the feeling towards the mother in the story.
Yeah, so the story will also be most about that relationship. And yeah, so I would say like the first few paragraphs are about that, and the next, but the last few aren't so much about it, but I kind of wanted to set up that ambivalence, that it can be as warm and as harsh.
Mm-hmm.
So have you already planned out the story completely?
Not completely. The way I write is that I first always have a kind of rough thing, so I write more kind of sentences to get the kind of feeling what I actually want to write about,
mm-hmm.
and then I write it into a kind of coherent text.
Okay.
And I haven't got everything yet in a kind of rough version, but say about half.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really plan it out because that would be too limiting, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do you know roughly where you're going with the story? Do you have an end in mind?
Yes, that I do.
Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. I think that's crucial. What I hear from people mm-hmm. who write prose, they tell me
mm-hmm.
that having a goal and the bigger steps mm-hmm. towards the goal is good to have in mind. And that's also where I fail, because I can never mm-hmm. think of an end point to a story. Mm-hmm. I might think of a beginning, but never of an end point.
Mm-hmm. I think it really depends, though. I think if you really actually write something in novel length, it makes sense to plan it. But then again, if it's a short story and you don't quite know at the beginning where it's going and you let it
yeah.
develop itself on paper, I think that's what I sometimes tend to do, or what I tended to do in the past when I wrote prose in German. I just started out writing and stopped whenever it felt appropriate.
Mm. I think that's also nice. I've heard some people tell about their technique in a way that for them they never know more than the protagonist mm-hmm. knows, and so they explore the world through the eyes of the protagonist mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. they write it.
Yeah, I do feel like I have an ending in mind, and that kind of in some ways what I'm writing is also to get to that place mm-hmm. to
okay.
understand why that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
So true. In some sense, I am also finding out about mm-hmm. the characters.
It seems like a healthy midway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds good. Also, it sounds a bit like solving a riddle, like you're trying to understand how they got there without actually the middle part having happened yet. So that's quite interesting.
It kind of feels also like how life progresses. You have the end in mind, inevitably, and you're finding out the middle parts gradually.
Yeah, and also when you make plans, you do also have a kind of ending in mind. Not specifically like the death in life, but when you make plans, you do have one.
Mm-hmm. Like a goal or something yeah. to yeah. work towards. Mm-hmm.
Just sometimes doesn't come to pass. And I guess that's a good metaphor for also writing.
Yeah.
Just don't always finish it.
Maybe the real story was the friends we made along the way.
Maybe.
Talking about your piece chronologically, you open up with the lines, the gift one a sense of a newborn being looked at. In a way, at least I read it that way, that people sort of bend down to look at the child or the newborn. And also, I think there's a line saying something like, there were all these sounds and psychology. People know that newborns have a different perception of senses. So sensual information is just an overflow and it's difficult to sort out. Was that actually intended to be a scene in which we talk about a newborn, because a little later that child already runs, leaves home, so it's never quite clear about which age we're actually talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the age thing is intentional to, because you don't, when you kind of maybe retell these memories to someone, you will maybe think, okay, how old was I?
Mm-hmm.
But then you kind of think about that for a minute. And actually, it's not really important to the memory. Mm-hmm. It's just something you kind of categorize to talk mm-hmm. about it. And true. I think if you would have that, it would kind of break the what it's supposed to be is kind mm-hmm. of what the emotions are.
Mm-hmm.
And what you said at the beginning, I kind of... I was thinking about that as well, that you kind of as a child, you don't know exactly how to maybe interpret the world. So it's just this thing happens and that thing happens without there being a what does this mean or...
Sure.
Yeah. And that was kind of the intention of the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find it easy then, once you think about what year a memory was in, do you find it easy to sort them into age groups?
No, it doesn't seem natural, kind of, to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For me as well. My childhood is all a blur, and there's like big dark patches where I can't remember much really.
Also, I think it's so fluid in the sense that you change a lot and your body changes a lot within a short time, and you first can't reach the door handle, and then a few years later you actually don't need to ask for help to get to the one place where you have chocolate, and then it changes so quickly that I think perhaps parents have a better overview of what happened when, because they are so keen on documenting all these things and taking pictures. But for oneself, it's just like, things happen and then other things happened.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much.
It's kind of interesting also with parents that you also obviously forget a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes you have memories that you can't remember what your parents told you. And then you feel like you could remember, but actually it's your parents' memory.
Yeah. I have loads of those. Loads of memories that aren't actually my own.
Yeah.
Or also memories that you see on pictures when you go through the family photo album.
Yeah.
And then you see yourself.
Yeah.
And what you have as a memory then is that picture, even though you don't have anything else really.
Mm-hmm. That's true. How memories can be created without you actually having made them or remembering them. Mm. Based on the texts, one could think that we've now been talking about the mother and narrator relationship as being like the central theme. When I read the text, I thought that the mother always becomes relevant when the narrator returns home. So would you say that the mother could be seen as a symbol for home, or just being intrinsically intertwined with the notion of home?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would kind of use the word maybe familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
It's the place to go back to that feels safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the character goes away and sees something new, and it's a kind of an adventure or something like that, and then goes back and comes back home. Yeah, so I think, actually that's probably right.
It's interesting that it's not so much the father, and it's not so much siblings or pets or a room, but that it's specifically the mother figure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's... I mean, how would you explain that?
Probably autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That would have been my next question. Like, is the narrator inspired by yourself, basically?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's written by me, so there's me in there.
Mm-hmm.
The more detail it becomes, the more it's not autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
I like this idea of lying to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of coming up with... Or there's this other really cool quote from Oscar Wilde, which is like, one's real life is the life one has not lived.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of coming up with something that didn't happen to you, but that feels like... It feels more evocative, actually, than maybe the stuff that did happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then... So that's kind of the detail, and then the broader stuff is probably relatively accurate about me. But that's also something that I can't really then control. I feel like I can control the details better than the overall stuff.
Does the father appear at all? I mean, there's two faces looking down at the protagonist in the beginning, and he's one of them, I assume.
Yeah, sure, but not as importantly.
Yeah. I like what you said about memories. Like, lying to tell the truth is that really kind of... Because you never really know whether a memory really happened exactly like you think it did, and still it is what it is, and there's no grasp on anything more tangible behind that. That's all we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I once wrote something that was supposed to be exactly, to try and be exactly like my memory, everything I remember, write it down. And it just turned out to be that there were way too many weird details that kind of didn't fit with the feeling I actually felt.
Yeah. How old were you when you did that?
Like 2 years ago or something. Okay.
Yeah, because I think I remember myself trying to do that as well.
Yeah.
And my theory now would be, it feels more possible when your memories are still fresh and you don't have as many.
Mm-hmm.
That it feels more possible and relevant to write them all down.
Do you think so? Well, perhaps, but I don't know, like... I think we're just so full of memories, and it's what you're trying to say, that, for example, a memory, like something just happens and ends and you write down things immediately and not too later. Or you're younger, you can...
When I was younger, like a whole history of myself, basically, all I could remember. I remember trying to do that. But right now I couldn't do that because my history... Well, I consider the history of my own life is not really a series of memories. It's mm-hmm. kind of muddy.
Yeah.
It's all grown together, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't be able now to like discern every single memory mm-hmm. from each other. It's kind of, it would be an impossible project now.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, is it actually something one would want? Because I think there are many phases in my life, especially my like late childhood, early teenage years, where I'm like, yeah, I'm happy these times are over.
Yeah.
So I actually sometimes prefer the presence. Yeah, probably over the past.
Yeah, and for me at least, there's a reason why. I just forgot lots of things because some things aren't worth remembering.
Yeah.
You have the feeling that fits with the years, but it's not the memories anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A question of a very different kind. I think the piece is very physical. Like, very often so it starts off with the perception of sounds, but then it turns to your mother touching your hair, then it turns into I think there's the moment where you talk about her legs when you return home, she kisses you and you hug her and you put your fingers against her back. So there are many moments that are very physical. And I remember the last Universe meeting where you read the text. I think someone also said this could be read between the lines as romantic relationship, sort of like, if, you know, taken out of any context.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about that?
So you say physical to then becomes romantic.
In a way, yeah. I know these are two things that should be distinguished, yeah. But could it be read that way? Would it be legitimate to see that?
Well, I'm certainly trying to write about love.
Mm-hmm.
The love between a mother and a child.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to say that's romantic, then...
I mean, it's definitely very physical. What it makes me think of is the German word Geborgenheit, mm-hmm. which is like
mm-hmm.
being held.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is very much what this is. It's somehow in an ambivalence between being held and then being away in the forest or some other place where not being held, but then also being around your mother, who's usually or sometimes holding you, and in those situations when she's writing, she's not holding you, and you're, but she's still there, and that creates a tension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice. Isn't it also, like, as children, I think that's something my mother once said, like, that it's good to also touch children a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that, yeah, they feel there's a kind of connection. Yeah.
I think it's necessary.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think children die if you don't touch them or hold them close to you.
Yeah.
And I think it makes the piece what it is to have, like, this physicality in there as well.
Mm.
Like, it's not this abstract return to home where you say, hi, mum, and run into your room. But where you actually feel with your body that you're back home as well.
Yeah. Kind of one of the main images in my mind for writing this is about... So as a text about love, and when they kind of hug each other, that on the one hand there's love that's kind of, should I say, flowing through mm. that connection, mm. but also so much else. So it's also the kind of character of the mother and the kind of feelings of the mother, not just love, but mm-hmm. all her other feelings mm-hmm. are kind of put through that connection.
Yeah, I remember that. That sounds so familiar. Like, that is what I totally get, because whenever my mom used to hug me, I could feel the difference in the hugs each time, depending on how well she was. Like, sometimes they hug you and you feel they are afraid or they are nervous and they have a bad day. Sometimes they hug you and it's, as you said, it's there's never really just love. There's always different emotions involved as well.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about that sentence, I think it's quite a central sentence in that text, that there is actually, but there is never just a smile, never just love. Is that something you would consider a larger theme in the text?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also, I'm thinking about also making it a kind of line that will return mm-hmm. and that actually the mother will say it.
Mm.
So one of the other interesting things for me about writing this is mother or parent or carer as a teacher of the
mm-hmm.
child, and that to a certain extent his view of that relationship is also, he's kind of learned to a way of looking at it also through his mother
mm-hmm.
and that it's, yeah. Yeah, and it's whether that's meant kind of positively or negatively, it's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. That, I think that sounds as if you had a Zen Buddhist sort of view on life, sitting in your room meditating and thinking, well, that's how it is. There's never just love, but well. When I read the text, I found it a bit, I think I would have personally read it in a more, like, not disappointed, but just a bit of a resigned manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's also meant that way. This is also, they keep saying, yeah, there's these two characters, like, mm-hmm. there is never just love, but actually they wish there was.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of what I... Yeah.
That's sad.
Mm. It's something they strive for, maybe, but it's always out of reach.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's because we're human beings and we're so faulty and so full of imperfections that I think the idea of pure love is an impossibility, probably.
Yeah. Maybe not so much on the part of the child, but generally mm-hmm. for all the people, love is also work, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There is commitment involved, and you need to do stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a feeling.
Not just being there or being there. already being there for someone implies that you need to be there for them emotionally and be there physically or be there to spend time with them. It's not just...
It's not passive at all.
No, yeah.
Going back to the faces at the beginning of the story, they kind of seem like a symbol of control. Like, they look back at you and it feels a bit like the narrator is maybe a bit tiny bit afraid of the way the faces sometimes look at them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly also about how big they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's kind of scary. So that's, yeah. As I said before, I think I'm trying, at least at the start, to just make it, okay, there's a face here. That's, mm-hmm. that's all that the child can actually kind of grasp in that mm-hmm. moment. And, but, yeah, certainly. But it's also supposed to be about kind of love.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just scary.
So weird how much bigger everything is when you're small,
mm-hmm.
and then without you realizing it, one day you're the same size, and it's just you don't seem to notice it in everyday life anymore.
Yeah,
because it's been such a gradual change.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, there's a second passage talking about, I think, the mother's face, either in connection with them. I think when you return home, when the narrator returns home, the narrator doesn't want to see the mother's face. Why is that? I think faces are a theme in there also, I think.
Yeah, in that specific case, it's because he saw her face then when she was angry, and he kind of doesn't want to see it again,
mm-hmm.
because the implication of it is just too big. And that's, in this case, that's why he doesn't want to look mm-hmm. at mm-hmm. her face. Because it's just too much, there's too much,
mm-hmm.
it's too important, like,
yeah.
too emotionally involving to,
mm-hmm.
yeah, to look at it.
Do you think children just want to see the mother's faces when they are peaceful and happy and loving? Because otherwise it feels like you have disappointed someone you love so much.
Yeah, I also think as a child you don't realize that your parents have a different life when they're not
mm-hmm.
Around you. So then every time they are sad, it automatically you start thinking it's you.
Yeah, that's that's very relatable. Yeah. Slowly realizing that your parents are actually people
mm-hmm.
is...
Yeah.
And that is not your fault or not the children's fault all the time if something goes wrong, but there are so many things happening in them and they are such complex beings. And I think as a child you also want to see your parents happy, right? Like ideally they are in a good condition.
Mm.
Because it's scary when they're not happy.
Yeah, you don't know how they're going to react. I think that's also... something I found in your text, or perhaps I just interpreted it, but I thought, like this, oh, I think there's a line saying, you never really quite know whether your mother is in a, what she is that day, how she is that day. So you need to check first with her face in order to know how to react.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think... Your parents, or your mother in this case, is so central to your mm-hmm. life that then, depending on which mood, it changes your mood as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. So, that's why it's really important.
I find the sweet eating scene really, really great. I don't know, it's just so, on a childlike level, really just like just what you think you do when you are mm. a child, and now it seems of course amazingly irrational, but in a way that I don't know, that's what children do. I mean, they seek pleasure without any kind of, without any thoughts of what might come of it. Mm-hmm. And I also find the line really good that your mother thought that you'd have, that the narrator had punishment enough.
It's just by laughing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something children do. I remember having loads and loads of sweets with my cousin, and it was just so unfair because my cousin could eat much more than me, so I would always get sick before him. And that's just, you know, I felt each time I had lost the race.
You know what that sounds like? Footnote. When you envy somebody else's foods.
Not some his food. We bought it together and then started eating. And then there was the plan, you know, to have sweets. So we watched Titanic and we wanted to eat. not Titanic. It was...
It's a bit of a weird movie to watch as a child.
No, it was weird. Traumschiff. Cruising series.
It's a rom-com series kind of...
Yeah, so they go into the, I think, Mediterranean or something, and there's like this old captain you can rely on, and then they have parties on, very elegant parties with jazz musicians. It's very fancy, the whole thing. And we watched it together, and then we wanted to eat sweets, but the thing is, you know, I had to stop after 10 minutes because I got sick. And my cousin was just, like, much taller than me, though he's 2 years young, 2 days younger than me. So I found it very, just unfair. As a child, you want to, you know, actually win the battle of having most sweets.
Yeah, for eating more.
Okay.
It seems like a base instinct, kind of.
I think it's about the principle, like, why can he eat much more than me without getting sick? That's just not fair. Yeah. Why is my body not equally equipped? Yeah.
Children do have a really strong sense of what's fair and what's not. That's really important, that if something seems not fair, that's...
Your whole world is... crumbling.
Yeah, I find we learn to, well, I guess we have to learn to deal with that a lot more, because otherwise it would be impossible to survive in the world if you react this strongly to unfairness still.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, but children also, when they are kind of profiting and it's unfair for someone else, they're not as... They don't feel that bad. But it depends on, I guess, the person.
But
I think the feeling of being unfairly treated in a negative way is very strong, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The sweet eating scene we just talked about takes place in nature, which I find very interesting, because generally nature seems to be a place to retreat to, as we've mentioned a couple of times, a place for adventures, a place to... be away from home and perhaps being controlled. And so what does nature generally mean to the narrator? Or will nature be used that way as a place of retreat in the rest of the piece as well?
Retreat as well. Also a place, as I said, to explore.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I actually wasn't even, in the sweet scene, wasn't even thinking of nature, just a park.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, place to play,
Mm-hmm.
Which,
The scene that blew me away the most was the ending, the dream of the woman rising out of the pond. It was really, it's written in a way that's so immensely dreamlike. It feels like, it really captures the feeling of what a dream feels like.
Thank you.
What would you say, what does it mean? What does the Lady of the Lake tell us?
I've always liked the way sometimes in stories or in films, they use fantasy to evoke a feeling that you can't really pinpoint, or it doesn't have a... If it's kind of vague and you can't exactly explain it, it doesn't have a clear meaning, although it has maybe some meanings. But it feels like a better or more powerful way of describing it, even if you're not entirely sure what it is.
Mm-hmm. Something like a visual metaphor, something like
that.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird how the text at the same time does such a good job at putting feelings into words that are hard to formulate, and then maybe those that are impossible to quite push into the strict form that words are still represented in that kind of dreamlike metaphorical way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even though it makes them harder to interpret maybe than the other ones, but they're still there.
How would you interpret that scene? Is it actually a dream? Is it the boy standing by the pond and actually seeing that or imagining that? Or having his subconscious feelings transformed into a visual metaphor?
Yeah, yeah. Something like that. I mean, there's obviously a clear connection between the fact that it's a large woman and the mother.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it kind of supposed to show how kind of powerful she seems to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kind of like a mythological creature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then also the kind of the pond, which in my mind is like this really dark place, but it's somehow kind of also warm, so she lives there because it's a sort of warm, dark place.
Okay.
Which would kind of, in my mind, be similar to the place when they are hugging, which is also a bit dark and warm. So those are kind of my connections, which I don't even maybe explicitly say, but it's just what I...
It's interesting, though, that this woman has, I think, a very furious expression on her face. Why is the expression so negative, so threatening, if it's actually related to the mother figure?
You say she gives a howl.
Yeah, because there's both the love, and in this case, in this specific dream, and the fear.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think now we're getting there. Fear hasn't been something we have talked about till now, right? Like the...
Fear of their faces that we've talked about.
True. But also, is it a fear of facing her emotions, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I also meant when we were talking about fear of faces, that they show what she's going through, and then... Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the howl is everything packed in one that you, as a child, usually don't notice that much, or the other things going on with your mother or your father.
You do notice them, but you don't understand it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a nightmare, I guess, so...
Mm-hmm.
But you, in the dream, become aware of something that's that you notice but don't notice when you're awake. You pick up on it, but you can't rationalize it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... what would Freud say?
He might start talking about the Oedipal complex. Maybe.
Doesn't he always?
Yeah.
For example. Or fear of women. I think Freud had issues with his mother, so he might have a whole chapter in that somewhere. If we were to read that, actually. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
In really complicated language. Yeah.
Also a bit outdated, perhaps.
A bit problematic at times.
A bit.
You put it into better words, I'd say.
I agree.
Okay. Thank you.
I think it is a form of psychoanalysis, certainly, just in more abstract terms and in more like visual terms, more painted for the readers, rather than saying this is a symbol for indicating that. So I guess it resounds a lot with literary people like us, right?
Yeah. I feel like, yeah, that's like, it's inevitable for writing that it ends up being a bit of a psychoanalysis, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think I've said that on the pod before, that I think you can only kind of tap into what you are and you know yourself, because mm-hmm. we didn't have any connection to anything else, really.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
True.
But I think then the interesting thing about writing is also that you can sometimes you come up with these images and then they start explaining you to yourself a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in a way, you can do psychoanalysis through the text,
mm-hmm.
not being entirely conscious of it while actually writing it.
True. I agree. Yeah, writing can be a revelation, obviously.
I think that's a good note to end the podcast on. This was episode 7 of the Universe podcast. If you enjoyed it and would like to hear more of us, make sure to subscribe to the Universe podcast wherever you're listening to it. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review to tell us what you think and help other people find the podcast. It would really help us out. And tell all your friends about it. Comments? Questions? You can reach us on Twitter, we're at PodUniverse, on Facebook, or via our email address, podcast@universe.univ.org. This podcast was edited and hosted by Leonard Engelmeier. The co-host was Livia Regen. Our guest on this episode was Lasse Pröbsting. On the editorial board for this episode was also Livia Regen. I hope you visit this planet in the universe again. In the meantime, stay safe in space. Thanks for listening.